Ian Hunter is arguably one of the greatest British songwriters. The former frontman of Mötley Hoople has maintained a 40-year solo career of great songs and incredible lyrics. In this interview, he details his life growing up in the Midlands, in Shrewsbury, Northampton, the backwater town to Britain where all the genius lurks. His days fronting Mötley Hoople, his relationships with people like David Bowie, and his 40-year solo career, and his idiosyncratic take on songwriting.
Dressing up, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, Mötley Hoople were a good dressed up band, weren't they?
Well, that was Pete Watts, really.
Yeah.
Pete loved it, unashamedly loved it, you know.
The innovator, wasn't he?
Yeah. And anything Pete did, the Dolls, you know, Arthur was a huge Pete. Mm. He loved Pete.
He copied him.
Completely copied him.
Pete, you're beautiful.
He was massive, you know. Little tiny voice.
And Slade as well, I think.
Noddy, yeah.
Did they come down and see Mötley Hoople in 69?
They came to Guildford Civic. No, Wolverhampton. Yeah, because I saw him at a gig in Germany and we wound up in the pub and he said, we all come down. And that was the night we decided to form a band because we thought if you could do it, anybody could.
So it was a backhanded compliment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of my regrets of being 48. I wish I'd seen Mötley Hoople in that early period.
Yeah.
Because people like Mick Jones always tell me what a great band that was.
It was desperation, it was a shambles, and that's good stuff, you know. We never thought that at the time, but it actually was good stuff, you know. It was either that or the factory. Stan used to say, you know, Wiggins is Monday morning on the way to the gig to just rev them up.
Yeah.
Yeah, because people weren't queuing up Ireland. We got on Ireland, but there was no other people wanted us, you know. So Ireland had us more or less by the balls, you know, contract-wise and everything.
But they looked after you, didn't they? They gave you four albums.
Yeah.
Which didn't really... No. They weren't big records, were they?
We wouldn't have lasted there. Now we wouldn't have lasted now. 5 minutes.
Mm.
Yeah, gigs were solid. That happened a lot in them days. You know, Adam Faith would be making singles, but Such was, you know, filling places every night of the week. You know, Tommy Bruce was filling places, you know. Jimmy Page's Nero and the Gladiators. A lot of them bands, they were filling out, whereas the pop in them days wasn't filling out gigs, you know.
So it's what you either sold records and sold tickets and no records.
Yeah, that was us, but well, we knew eventually something's got to happen. Because we were doing 2,000-3,000 seaters and we were filling them, and you can't do that without a record for any length of time. People just fall off. You'll keep your core, you'll keep your Mick Jones people, but you'll lose the casuals because you're not all over the press and in the charts and on the radio, you know.
So it's just a matter of getting the right record, the right sound. Because Guy Stevens, I mean, God bless him, but he was chaotic, wasn't he? He was managing you, wasn't he? You were managing him in a sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were over in the States and it was like, this is ridiculous. I mean, you know, where is he? We're fishing him out of places and picking him up and... I loved him, I mean, we all did, but to call him a manager is like ridiculous, you know. And we were jealous of people like Roxy who had this steady situation going on behind them, you know, the organisation behind them, you know. Ours was just a mess. And very frustrated, you know.
I mean, what is it about you? You seem to attract these kind of maverick characters.
I do love characters. I do love characters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was in a Muso band for a little while once, and you've heard of all of them. And I just remember being on the bus and listening to the previous night's gigs, which to me is like hell. And just thinking, this is the last place I want to be on earth. I mean, if you're going to do it, you should enjoy it, you know. They seem to be enjoying it, but I wasn't at all. I'd much rather the chaos, you know.
Mm. So was it be like touring Mott, it would be chaos on the bus?
Yeah, they're quite natural. They weren't putting it on. They were all... I think I was the sanest one of them all. I mean, what they were getting up to. And they were all totally different, you know. And so that kind of worked for a while as well.
But my friend who's coming tonight, actually, his auntie went to school with Pete Watts and Anne Buffett and said they were just completely mental characters at school.
Yeah.
They would be setting fire to desks, setting fire to the teacher. Like, maybe Pete Watts would be
doing it. There'd be a logical reason for that. That was the weird thing with Pete. He could rationalise anything. Quite intelligently, too. It's like, fuck, pantomime. You know, is it me? But as bad as great as it was also, they're very Hereford. I called them the Hereford Mafia. You know, there were certain things they weren't going to do. I mean, to get them to London was a nightmare. Then the States cropped up. They weren't going there. I mean, they were still going back to Hereford on the weekends. You know what I mean? They're very much. I read that book, The Undertones, wrote, like, dedicated to failure type band. You know?
Yeah.
It was kind of like that. Yeah, they didn't really want to. When De Vries was managing us, it was a nightmare, you know. So I can't really blame managers per se, because we're pretty much unmanageable, you know.
Because the band, and one of the reasons people love the band, because it was unlike Dire Rock and Roll Star. It was like the small town band that somehow got into the big time, wasn't it?
Yeah. I wanted it, you know. Until we got it, I really wanted it. I mean, that's the whole idea, really, isn't it? Mm. Whatever you do, you want to get somewhere with it. But, and every time we just did New York, and it was great, and it was like, well, this can't be my earful, because every time we did New York, we blew it, you know, like, or even we didn't blow it, like the sound system would break down, or something like that would happen, you know. In Bumshit, Idaho, we'd be great, no problem, but the minute we hit LA, or, you know, like, we always, I was dreading the Beacon, and the Beacon was fabulous.
So what was it like with Main Man with that? Because obviously he's got a reputation, had a reputation, very ambitious, driving manager.
Yeah.
The opposite. So was he just completely confounded by Mott the Hoople?
Well, David was too. They couldn't quite understand, like, what the Freeze couldn't understand was, he just told David would say yes or no to any specific thing during the course of the day. But with our lot, you know, it had to be 5-0, as you've heard before, I'm sure. I've said it many times. Couldn't be 3-2, couldn't be 4-1, had to be 5-0. And there's always one who was being an asshole at the time, or insecure, or whatever. And so we never got anything done. And David took me out the stage, Daddy says, you're going to have to do something here, you know. And because it looked like I was the leader from the outside. I always remember, because we were in the City Squire, David was in some posh hotel, I forget which one it was. We went to stage Delhi. And then I went back to City Square, I got them all in my room. I said, okay, this is what's going to happen. And David's saying I should run the band, because only one person got it. And before I even finished the sentence, Ralph went, like, fuck. That was the end of that, you know.
So the real problem with the Hoople is five leaders.
Five very strong personalities, yeah.
Yeah, and also that's one of the great things about Mott the Hoople at the same time.
Yeah, I loved them. I love all of them, but that was a nightmare, you know.
Yeah. So the amazing thing about Mott the Hoople has actually lasted as long as it actually did.
Yeah. I mean, I was exhausted at the end of that lot. And it was like, well, why are you leaving?
Because you're in a hospital bed.
Not seeing what's been happening around here.
I mean, so when you initially came back to Mott the Hoople, it's the classic lineup, so-called classic lineup.
Yeah.
But this lineup, you wanted to do this lineup as well, didn't you, to incorporate that into the show?
Yeah.
But I can understand it could be awkward to original members, can't it? But
yeah,
it would have been great actually as a theatrical piece, wouldn't it? Kind of the history of Mott in a way, wouldn't it?
Yeah. To me, I don't see the problem. I mean, every time you do it, there's a hiccup in sales, and you know, people ring you up and say, we're putting out vinyl now, which they wouldn't do if I didn't do this.
Mm.
You know, it's a little hiccup for everybody, a little bump. They really didn't want to include Morgan and Luther. And I understood, I got it totally. But I'd been with Morgan and Luther, and Luther especially, you know, he'd saved the day at the time. And I thought they were owed, and particularly as they came to both those get-togethers that we did 2009, 2012, and they were great about it. They weren't bothered. You know, I remember Luther coming in at the O2 afterwards. I don't give a shit what anybody says. The best year of my life ever, you know.
Mm.
And I just thought, if I get a window, we've got to do this, and that's what we're doing.
Mm. I mean, he is a great guitar player, isn't he? In a kind of very unconventional way.
Darby, yeah. You know, it's an abstract way that he plays that people confuse people. You know, but. He's a great guitar player, and everything is still the same now. I mean, the energy level is alarming, you know. Just, and he's such an upper to be in a band. And Morgan's Well, you'll hear it, you know, he plays gorgeous.
I watched it all on YouTube.
Yeah.
Bands do sound fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, because it's the Ramp bands, it's...
Well, they've been doing rock material, for, like I say, you know, for a long time. So what am I going to do? Go out and get, like, session guys? The only logical thing to do is what we did, you know.
Yeah. Hmm. So when you revisit the Motley Hoople stuff, I mean, you play a lot anyway, don't you, in solo shows?
Well, do Memphis, do stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah. So to you, it just, it's almost like doing... Just touring anyway, your annual tour, but
just
the two original guys popping in.
It's a bit more energetic, actually. The nature of the set itself is a bit more energetic. It's a good set. I like the set. But it does take a little more out on you. I think it's because I do piano on my, in my own situation. I do about like a third piano. Whereas we're in this, you know, Morgan's there, so there's no point. So I'm just posing away in the middle with a fucking guitar that's not heard, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But when you do the piano, you know, at my age, you sit down for a third of the set. That's cool. This, I'm not allowed, you know, I have to do it all the way through.
Well, Bob Dylan sits down for virtually the whole set now, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah. He's still going, he's still got it.
Well, it's amazing, I mean, he's younger than you, though, isn't he?
A couple of years younger than me,
yeah.
And he knows that, too. He told somebody, yeah, I had a Swedish fan, played the Globe in Stockholm. Yeah, and apparently he mentioned that to a fan of mine who had a T-shirt with my name on it. Walked past and says, I'm younger than him.
So you want the yardstick? The one
that's... Yes! He knows me. I'm still like a 12-year-old when it comes to Bob, yeah. Yeah, that Bob's the yardstick for me, yeah. You know, for a lot of people.
But for many, I mean, many of us growing up, Bob Dylan was great, of course, but because you were... an English version, we could totally relate to what you were singing about. And for us growing up at that time, we preferred your lyrics because they're about our world in a sense. Yeah. You know?
But I didn't understand his lyrics. I just knew he was right. I mean, the first time I ever saw him, I don't know what the fuck that is, but it's amazing. You know, still to this day, I think he's one of the best comedians in the world, you know.
He does have a wry sense of humour.
Yeah, I mean, that book he wrote, it's like the Chronicles, it's like... Come on. It's great, you know. I don't believe it.
I mean, the other big influence was the Stones as well, wasn't it? I mean, how do you write to them these days? You still...
Stones are like any great rock band, you know, like 1 out of 10. And I remember seeing the Stones. It would have been maybe mid-80s or something. They had a big flower that went over Madison Square Garden for a week. And I went about the fourth night, and they weren't very good at all. I saw Dylan outside the other end later on that night, and he said, "What did you think of the Stones?" And I said, "Bob Dylan asked me about the Rolling Stones." So I said, "Well, they weren't all that great, you know." Like, and he said, "Nah, apathy for the devil." So I went straight over to apathy for the devil. You know? Yeah.
I mean, when you see those bands, you know they got the stadium level, and Motley Hoople is big, weren't they? But cult in a sense, you know, it was nearly there. Is it frustrating?
No, not at all. I mean, we would do places like the Philadelphia Spectrum. Admittedly, Aerosmith would be opening, or you know, the Queens. But that's an 18,000 seater. We were doing all right. A lot of places, no. 2,000, 3,000, the odd 10,000. Milwaukee, I remember, was a 10,000 seater. Long Beach, some areas. I mean, Cleveland. Doing for a week, you know. But in the main, you know, LA was Santa Monica Civic, which was probably, what, 1,800, 2,000, something like that. So they were big in some places and smaller in others.
Because you've always said you preferred being on the periphery, but, I mean, that's obviously not the periphery as I would understand it. That's a big periphery, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think when a band gets into that stadium thing, it kind of spoils it quite?
I didn't like it at all. I mean, the bit that I saw, I mean, we saw it from, I always say a fortnight, but I don't know how long it was, but I didn't like it at all. Because a lot of things come into play. Like what we just did, 2,000 to 3,000 seaters in America just, and you see the scalping that's going on. You know, you just, people buying tickets for $40 and selling in Cleveland for $500. Making money out of money. There's no talent attached to that. It makes you sick. I'm a club guy, that don't happen. You know, you just pay you and you get in, and that's it, you know, simple. And the minute you start getting a little bit bigger, all the shit starts flying, and that's what I don't like about it. You know? I was in it for the original. I was in it for Little Richard, Catherine Granada, Sam Cooke opening.
Wow.
I was in it for Bobby Orley at Leicester Du Montfort. That's what I was in it for, you know, when you're 14, 15, 16. That's having not existed until that point. And then hearing that.
The world went Technicolor when Little Richard turned up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was a governor. I've never heard anybody sing like him before or since. So.
And in a way, what you do is you maintain that spirit at that moment to this day.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
A bit lacking in the talent department because they were all great. They were, I mean, Jerry Lee and all that. That's why I never thought I'd be in the business. I just thought, I mean, them guys could sing and play, you know, they really could. But I was just a fan. You know, I was a fan of PJ Proby. I was a huge fan of Proby. Never thought I'd ever actually. It was an accident along the way somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you do have a talent as a songwriter, don't you? That's.
I found that out later. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was something I could do. You know.
So initially, at first, it's just the excitement of seeing these people on stage. You had to be on stage. Yes. But you didn't know how you were going to get onto the stage because you couldn't play anything. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember going. I saw Lauren Hardy at Shrewsbury. Shrewsbury Granada. I just remember, I wanted to know what was going on backstage. I mean, it was great seeing them, but my whole thing was, it must be amazing backstage, it must be another world, you know. And that's usually the sign of you want to be in the business at some point, yeah.
And when you finally got to the bit where there was a backstage,
yeah,
then it started from
well, you know, the side. Here we are.
Yeah, it's kind of the same colored walls around the world, isn't it?
Exactly palatial, is it?
Yeah.
Needs a hoovering.
Yeah. Bit like dying rock and roll star as well, when you hoover the flat before you fly to America.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I like normal stuff. I've never liked the stupid stuff, you know.
Yeah.
No. It's not what it's made out to be, you know what I mean? I know a lot of people say that, and then a lot of people think, well, you're full of shit. But, I mean, yeah, it's nice if you can get around, if you can walk in a shop and buy something. That's great and all the rest of it, but I've never felt like I needed a boat or a jag or something posh. I've never had that problem, and I'm lucky because a lot of people have that problem, you know. I never did.
Is that because it took you 15 years of working in factories, being in the real world, being grounded?
More than likely because you know what it is, you know what the opposite is, and I remember thinking, this is not right, this isn't going to work. The other end, I'm thinking the other end, even then, when I was 17. This ain't working, British Timken, you know, like, this isn't going to work. A premium bond, a month or a week, it's not going to work. I mean, if all you've got to look forward to is Littlewoods, I didn't trust that. I thought, you've got somewhere down the line, you're going to have to do something to get out of this, you know.
So was it purely music, that was the only way you could get out, or was there other options you could...
Well, in them days, for kids like us, you know, it was football music, and I was crap at football. Mm. And I'm glad I was crap at football, because right now I'd be athletic, you know, which I'm not.
Yeah, so, yeah. So rock and roll was actually good for your health?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Young man's game, you know.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
When did you realise you actually had some kind of musical talent? Did it take a few years, or did it sort of manifest quite early? Could you imagine the songs in your head, but you couldn't actually play them? How did it all come together?
I had a little band around Northampton, like I said. Mm-hmm. And then I saw this bloke in a pub one night. I was going around like, looking for gigs in the surrounding area of Northampton, and I saw this bloke by a jukebox, and it was Freddie Fingers Lee, who had been with Such, the piano player. And Fred had had an accident. He'd come off at Liverpool...
Empire?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, the sloping stage? The piano had come off on top, and he'd been under it. He'd gone down. And the last thing he remembered was Such looking at him and ring the papers. That was the last thing he remembered. Yeah. And Such immediately got Paul Nicholas, the guy that later became one of those West Coast, West End stars. You know?
Old Grandma's Paul
tonight. Nicholas. To replace him and left him in the hospital, and he's sitting there on his own, and he gets out and he goes back to Steeler acting, which is how I met him in this pub. Mm-hmm. He's covered in dust, but he had a glass eye and Pebble been there, so I knew it was Fred, and I walked up to him. I said, you know, you're Freddie Fingers. He said, I thought I was going to hit him. It's all like, I said, no, I'm a huge fan of yours, you know. So he joined the band I was in Northampton, I'd been trying to sing and everything. He said, no, 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 you go over there and play the bass. So we sat the bass player, and I got a bass, and I just went up and down the bass note. Before I found out what the other three were, I just went up and down like that. And Fred could still go to Hamburg, you know, all these German places. And so you'd get a job for 6 weeks, and then you would go with Fred, and you'd be playing 9 hours a night. So I figured out the rest of the strings, so now I'm a bass player, you know. And he was like, encouraging me songwriting. He said, don't ever sing, but like, your songwriting's good, that's what you should concentrate on. And so from there, I went to Francis Day and Hunter, and they were paying me 15 quid a week to write songs for Engelbert and Tom Jones. Me and Roger Glover, yeah.
Okay.
Doing that for 15 months, and then the call, I met the Mots.
Oh, for the famous audition where you did the 10-minute bass solo. Is that what you've been learning for 3 years?
I was desperate. Anything. I wanted that gig so bad, you know.
You just played... Did you play one of the songs you've written in that?
I played Laugh At Me. They always say. I played like a rock star. I did. I played Laugh At Me, Sonny Bonham.
Yeah. And that's an interesting influence as well, because he's not... You know, because ostensibly, I guess they were almost a proto-progressive rock band. You wouldn't like some like Sonny Bonham, would they? And you come in... It's kind of a really weird raft of influences that you've got, haven't you?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I just thought he was great, because to me, as a songwriter, CF&G, you write a song around CF&G that's great, which he did on more than one occasion. That's some, you know, you can write a song around 15 different modulations and God knows what else. But to just those two chords or those three chords, and he did it consistently. Mm. And he is also Phil Spector's engineer, so he knew a bit about the other side of it as well. No, he's a very talented bloke.
Well, no, it's a great song, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I did that, because I wasn't that great a singer, so he wasn't either, so that's what I was doing. I was copying Bob and copying Sonny Bonham.
But you totally found a space where your voice works.
Mm.
I mean, I guess that's
what it takes
tricks.
A while, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's what Guy liked. That's what kept me in the band. Because the first 9 months, it was really... The band didn't want me at first, and Guy did. And then there was a period where... things turned and Guy wanted me out, and then the band wanted me to stay. So the first 9 months were really dodgy. You know?
Mm.
Yeah.
They're already in a unit, aren't they? So you're kind of parachuting in, aren't you?
Well, at first, yeah, it was really strange. I mean, they had a flat in Lower Sloane Street, just off Sloane Square, and I went, and Stan was the only one that spoke to me. And this is me in the band, and I don't know anybody, and nobody's talking to me. Stan's the only one, yeah. And yeah. Stan, I'm replacing. I'm wondering when he's going to poke me, you know. Yeah.
Strange dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. I remember Buff passing me on the stairs and never looked at it.
Yeah.
Straight past, no.
Yeah. So what did it take to win their confidence or the other way around? To just tight?
They were always tight, you know. And Mick Rouse perhaps a little less tight. Because Mick was quieter and more West Country-ish than actual Hereford. But Pete, Fally and Buff... They were very tight. They were very tight, yeah.
Because they went back.
I always felt like I was from somewhere else. Although I was only from Shrewsbury up the road, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I always felt a bit outside that band, yeah.
Yeah. So when you start bringing songs in, is that when they start to realise that you're actually a bit kind of useful?
Well, what happened was Pete and Mick were the writers.
Mm.
And Pete, all he wanted to do was pull birds, you know, so... The minute we started happening, he just wasn't, oh, you do it, you know, you can do it, you're better than I am, you do it. And so that's how I started, you know, for serious writing, you know. And we were in Islington, I think it was the Angel, it was a pub in Islington, and they had all this gear. And I'd never, you know, all I had was, a guitar or something, probably. I can't remember what I had. I didn't have a record player. I got one of them little singles jobs.
Downset.
Little green thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so to see all this gear. So I started turning up like 4 or 5 hours before they did and playing on all the stuff. And that's how a lot of that stuff got written on that first record. Not that there was much written for the first record, but I remember Afternoon Bay, yeah, because Fally's organ was there, you know, and I'd never really experienced that before.
Mm.
Sustain instead of just like... Just playing a piano, you know, you could sustain. You know, there was always gear, so they'd turn up at 3, and you'd play them a bit of something. And they were great that way. They were totally unselfish that way. They were like, if they heard anything, straight away, what's that? you know. And so that's how it worked. Mick would come in with bits, I would come in with bits, Fally would come in with bits, and the others would go like, yeah, what is that? So it was great that way.
So there you are, you have this reputation, this kind of probably the toughest live band in Britain or whatever it is, and then this really bizarre thing happens that David Bowie gives away probably the best song he's ever written.
Yeah.
And he just gives it to Mott the Hoople, which is really weird. And it's also, I would argue, it's probably one of the cover versions where someone actually turns it into their own song as well. You know, it's, when you actually hear it, it's his version, you think, wow, is that kind of odd to listen to
it? Well, I think that's why we got it, to be honest with you, because I think he was fed up with it.
Yeah.
You know, and we just happened to be there at the right time, you know. I'm the same as you. He sat down and played it, and I'm like, what are you giving that away for, you know? But then he'd done it in C, which is a lower key. And apparently there's a lot of alto on it. I think Morgan's heard it, but I don't think I've ever heard it. And he just went out of ideas. But having said that, when we went down Olympic Barnes, and it was in two evenings, that and one of the boys, and he knew exactly what he wanted us to do. I remember he was spending time with Fally, with the organ and all that, and there was a lot of time spent on harmonies. He knew what he wanted. So why he hadn't done it himself, I don't know.
Do you think he felt like he needed a band like Mott the Hoople? You know, it had to be a tough, pretty rocking, tight band. Something weird in it. A weird little X factor that no one could ever put the finger on. And he saw that, didn't he? Do you think?
I don't know what he saw. I mean, I know he thought we were tough. I know that. Because I used to talk to Ange, and Ange would tell you. Like the first time he came to see us, it took me 4 hours to get ready. He told me this, you know. Whether that was an exaggeration, it probably was. And we were doing a tour for Ireland, and all of a sudden these flowers start appearing in the dressing room everywhere we go, you know. And Johnny Glover and Alex Leslie, the Ireland guys, they were like, "What the fuck's it? What's all these flowers doing here?" You know. And this was us being courted by David, you know. And I think he thought I was a motorcycle bloke before other. According to Andrew, that's what he thought, which wasn't true, you know, but I'll go along with that, I don't care.
He had a fascination with bands like that, didn't he? Like the Spiders and the same thing, a bunch of blokes from Hull that he brought down to London.
Yeah.
You know, I guess in ways in his head, he thought these kind of tough provincial bands would give his music a bit more oomph. Would that be it?
Maybe. I mean, Ronson pretty much converted him, you know.
Yeah.
He was a folk singer. I saw David in the 60s, maybe 66, you know, with the perm and the Reeboks, you know, doing that. And I thought, I don't know what that is, you know, but like after the show, there was a mile long of women out waiting to get in. And so he had this thing, you know, Dave. Yeah. Girls loved him.
So I guess because of almost time left, I want to know what you're doing apart from Mott the Hoople as well. You've written another album, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm in the back end of it, yeah. We'll see what happens next. Yeah, it's nice.
I mean, it's quite interesting because a lot of bands. I mean, yes, we talked about the Stones before. I mean, they're a jukebox band, aren't they? It's a great jukebox, great hits.
Yeah.
But you keep going. It's got this compulsion to keep writing, keep moving forwards.
Yeah.
And is that something you've always had? Is that?
You've got a motivation. Well, the only motivation that I can have is trying to be better than I was before. You know, that's the only motivation I've always had. And also, I'm getting old and I'm not supposed to do it, so that's motivation. There's a lot of motivation if you go looking for it, you know.
Well, you're trying to get it all in while you can now.
Well, you know, that's what we're here for, isn't it? We're not supposed to just sit in the kitchen and go, oh my God, and look at the clock, you know. No. As long as I'm on two legs and happening, you know. I don't see the point. I mean, I can't imagine not doing anything. I can't imagine anybody not doing anything, you know, unless they're fucked up.
But most bands, when they get to 40, just play the two hits and just go around playing these venues in circles, you know. I mean, yes, of course, that's what you'll be playing, the six hits tonight, etc. But,
yeah,
this is like a holiday from your normal pushing forward.
It's a fucking holiday.
A busman's holiday.
It's harder work than usual. Especially with him over there, you know, cramping me.
You have been listening to the John Robb Tapes with me, John Robb. Brought to you by Lush and Louder Than War, this podcast was produced and engineered by Andrew Payne. If you enjoy this, please retweet it and tell your mates. Thanks for listening.